Thank you. Please report again. Again, my name is Craig Johnston. I represent Mr. Wilbanks. Mr. Wilbanks will be parole eligible in 2066. Of course, he's likely to be dead by then because he will have to have served 67 years in prison just to make that mark. And this is for non-homicide offenses that were committed in a single criminal episode against a single victim. I think it's clear under Graham versus Florida that Mr. Wilbanks, who has in essence been sentenced to die for non-homicide offenses, cannot be. He is not going to be given a realistic opportunity for release. It's not meaningful, and it certainly won't be based on rehabilitation or maturation. It will be best based on whether or not he can overcome the odds and substantially outlive his life expectancy while still at the same time spending 67 years in prison.
Now his sentences were collectively 355 years?
Right, a life plus 355, and the life is treated for minimum term as 30, so it's the equivalent of a 385 years.
Don't other statutes provide that those would be calculated to be 75 and that he'd have to serve 85% of 75?
I think the way the Department of Corrections has calculated is that he has some minimum term sentences, and the Armed Criminal Act and one are not minimum terms. His minimum terms are stretched out so far that there's a geriatric provision that says, that says age 70 if you serve 40%, and obviously he will serve. But that geriatric provision only is within the minimum term offender statute. So the Department of Corrections has said that the 300 years of the ACA, they don't fall under the geriatric. There's a separate regulation that says if you're over 75 years, it's treated as 75 and you're eligible after 15. So what they do is for the minimum term, it's 70 years. And then for the ACAs, it's 15 years, and that's how they've calculated 85 years.
But being eligible doesn't mean you get released. Sirhan Sirhan may never get released. I mean, he's been up for parole a number of times, and parole boards don't necessarily grant it anyway.
Certainly, there's no guarantee he'll be released, but we know pretty much certainty he's not ever going to get released because there is no way he's going to live to be the age of 85 while spending 67 years in prison. And the Graham court made it specific that you can't make that decision at the outset. Okay, you may be able down the road when you have parole eligibility decide this is a bad dude. You know, you look at all these conduct violations, he's a threat in the institution. This person cannot be safe on the street. Okay, so you can at parole hearings make a determination this person can't. But at the sentencing hearing, at the outset, they said states cannot do is at the outset decide a juvenile non-homicide offender, Mr. Wilbanks, will never be fit to reenter society, 85, before he's even eligible. The sentencer has made a decision at the outset that Mr. Wilbanks will never be fit to enter society. And the sentencer cannot do that. The sentencer can obviously exercise some set of discretion in sentencing. However, there has to at least provide a meaningful opportunity for release. It's somewhat complicated by the fact that we have so many minimum term offenses. Because if we start stacking them up, it gets them too far. So it may be that the court cannot run all sentences consecutive. Because otherwise it would deprive him of a meaningful opportunity for release.
If we do have to set a line, how do we determine what it is?
Well, the courts really have not. To be quite honest, it's frustrating, I'm sure, because the courts have found de facto LWOP sentences, and their remedy has always been remand it back down in the trial court, let the trial court figure it out, and the courts really have not set a line. What's happened is I think five or six state Supreme Courts have done that, and then what happens is the legislature comes and cleans it up, And the line that the legislatures have drawn are 15 to 25 years.
What is there about Eighth Amendment jurisprudence that suggests that you don't look at each sentence separately?
Well, because because Graham for juveniles has started a new ball game. What Graham specifically says, because of the categorical category of juveniles, it said a threshold comparison between the severity of the penalty and the gravity of the crime does not advance the analysis. So what they're saying is, you know, when we're dealing with juveniles, we're not looking at how many offenses that were committed, what type of offenses are committed. What we're looking at is the juvenile.
Right. So in your view, if a juvenile 16-year-old man was in custody and committed two more murders while in custody, Eighth Amendment would prohibit.
Well, the murders
stacking the consecutive sentences, right, even if they were life with the possibility of parole.
The murders would take it out of the picture, because then we'd be in a Miller situation to where you could get life without parole for a murder.
I'm back to the multiple. That's why I don't understand why each sentence isn't looked at separately for purposes of Eighth Amendment.
Well, because the focus in Graham, in Miller, is on the juvenile. Because at the time of the juvenile, regardless of how many offenses they commit, they're under this twice diminished, especially for the non-homicide offenses, they're under the twice diminished culpability. First for the non-homicide offense, and then the juvenile. And what they recognize is, okay, this person may be committing a lot of crimes now, but when age 25 and on, and the brain matures and you rehabilitate, then we have a totally different person. And we're not going to keep somebody in prison for mistakes that were made before they had a chance to develop for the rest of their lives.
Graham, yeah. They said every juvenile has to have a possibility of parole if it's a non-homicide offense.
Exactly.
So it made a distinction between that and Miller, where there was a homicide offense.
It did, right. And Mr. Wilbanks does not have that. Now, the court, I mean, there's been some question, well, what about in Graham that suggests this should apply to multiple? Well, Graham himself suggests that it applies to multiple, because Graham committed two offenses, right? One was the life, one he got the life, and the other he got 15 on, an aggravated burglary and robbery committed at the same time, got probation on it, and actually went out, committed further offenses. They described it as a spree of robberies, right? So he gets his probation revoked, okay? And then he gets the life sentence and gets in. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court knew about all these crimes. They knew about all these facts, but they specifically said, this is a categorical basis. We're not looking at the facts of the crime. We're looking at the juvenile. The focus here is on the juvenile. Now, if the court is saying, if the opposing counsel is saying, okay, well, the whole problem was they had life in there, and on remand, Graham could get, okay, well, on remand, we'll remand him back down and give him 100 years. Consecutive, we'll give him like a 50 and a 50 consecutive, or a 70 and a 15 consecutive, to which he'll die in prison anyway. Well, then Graham really did nothing, right? And the court was aware that Graham could, right, that Graham had multiple sentences. And if all you're saying is all Graham means is that you can't write the word life in the sentence in judgment, but you can stack the sentences so that the juvenile spends the rest of his life in prison for non-homicide offenses, then Graham really has done nothing other than make the legislature and prosecutors be more innovative at stacking sentences.
Could you address the state's argument as to whether Graham applies to attempted homicides or even first-degree assaults? That those are homicide offenses within the meaning of Graham and Miller.
Well, certainly first-degree assault is not a homicide. I mean, first of all, it's not. It's an assault. It's a homicide. Secondly,
attempted murder, which I think has been more often litigated?
Well, with the attempted murder, even then, it kind of depends on which language you look at in Graham. At least the courts that hold one way look at one language and another. But bottom line is what I think makes an attempted murder even not a homicide offense is that the Graham court focused in on The difference between non-homicide and homicide is the irrevocability about homicide. They mentioned with a homicide offense, the murderer's victim dies. Okay, with an attempted murder, the murderer's victim does not die. So I think that takes it out of the homicide. The other thing is with Mr. Wilbanks, he was charged as attempted to kill or cause serious physical injury, so we would, first of all, he wasn't charged with the homicide offense. Secondly, we don't even have a jury finding because the jury could have found that he was attempting to cause serious physical injury. So certainly the homicide is off the situation with Mr. Wilbanks. We have a non-homicide offense. And so he cannot be sentenced to die in prison. And he has been, in fact, sentenced to die in prison. And that was the decision was made at the outset. I could say, let's say with a homicide is a life, he gets a life on the assault second, which certainly is permissible. And he has to do 85%, that's 25 and a half. Come parole time at 25 and a half, and they look at his institution record and say, no, this is an irreparably corrupt individual. Look at all the things that you've done. Look at the conduct violations you've done. You have shown no, they can keep him in. But under Montgomery, if they look at him, and this is not an irreparably corrupt person, and it turns out, you know, actually, this person has turned his life around. He's remorseful, he's shown rehabilitation, he's matured, then Montgomery says he has to be released. The actual language they say is, on Montgomery must be given, this is a homicide offender, not even a non-homicide offender. Montgomery must be given the opportunity to show the crime that did not reflect irreparable corruption. And if he did not, their hope for some years of life outside of prison must be restored. And here, Mr. Wilbanks has no chance to have years outside of prison to be restored. He has no hope. He has no chance to reconcile with the community. He has no chance to rehabilitate himself, or at least make it a meaningful rehabilitation.
I think Squeaky Fromm has been in prison for 30 years. She missed. I don't think she hit anyone. She shot at Terry Ford. But she's been in prison for 30 years. She'll never get out.
Right. And same way with, although not a juvenile, Manson, right? I mean, he's eligible for parole, but let's face it, he is not ever getting parole. Mr. Wilbanks should get an opportunity to show which side of the fence he's on.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Mike Spillane. I represent the Department of Corrections. The first thing I'm going to say here is a lot of categories have been sort of smushed together, and I think there's an easy way to analyze this case, and I'll get to it. The form of action here is important. This was a declaratory judgment action in the trial court. The Department of Corrections moved for judgment on the pleadings on a legal issue. The Court of Appeals opinion drops out, so we're still here on the appeal of the denial of a declaratory judgment action, and that's important for big and small reasons. I see you have a question.
I was going to say, he filed the DJ action, if I recall, because he filed a habeas action, and the state said you should have filed a DJ action.
Exactly right. I told them that they should go in declaratory judgment, and they did, and I think they were right to. And I'll explain why. Okay. And it has to do with your remedies as well, if you decide to rule against the department. Habeas corpus is about challenging your confinement. That is, you want immediate discharge from confinement, you want to challenge a judgment of conviction and sentence, you want to challenge prison conditions that rise to the level of cruel and unusual punishment, and you want to be discharged from those specific conditions, say there's rats in the prison. But here, in the declaratory judgment action, they say, and correctly so, we are not challenging the judgment of conviction and sentence. We are saying the parole statute and regulations as applied to us are unconstitutional. They say we don't want resentencing, it would be unworkable. And that's where we're at. We're on an appeal of the district court, the circuit court, we're in state, saying there's no Eighth Amendment violation here as a matter of law when we move for judgment on the pleadings. And the reason I bring this up is, although the Court of Appeals ruled in our favor on the Eighth Amendment analysis before they did it. They converted it into a habeas action, and their point relied on asks for relief in habeas. Now, if they're challenging the constitutionality of the parole statute, there's no problem with resentencing. If you disagree with me, then you just say the statute as applied to him is unconstitutional. He should be parole eligible on date X. That happens all the time in declaratory judgment actions when the parole board of the department determines a person is eligible on date X.
We have treated all these other cases through habeas. Are you suggesting that was
this
wrong?
This is different, and I'll explain why.
Okay.
The case you heard Mr. Hawk argue, the gentleman was sentenced to life without parole eligibility for 50 years. That was part of his sentence. There's no sentence like that here. You have a life with parole and various terms of years. And I'll tell you another case that I think supports this analysis.
He was sentenced consecutively here, right?
Yes.
So he's just saying that's unconstitutional.
Right, but in his pleading in the trial court, which he did in declaratory judgment, and I think is correct, he said, I'm not saying my sentence is unconstitutional, I'm saying the way the parole statute. And that's different because you don't run into the argument you do in the other cases about what can we do to fix a sentence. This guy isn't complaining about a sentence. And since the opinion dropped out of the Court of Appeals, I won't go into procedural default, but I think it's to his advantage to have it tried in declaratory judgment. Because there are procedural bars in habeas that I can't assert in declaratory judgment that I would be happy to assert. So I don't think the plaintiff should argue too hard with me about the form of action. And the reason in the big picture that's important is habeas corpus turns appellate courts into trial courts. There's a narrow range where that should happen. But the constitutionality of a statute from reading the statute isn't one of those. Also, it messes up venue in the trial courts. If you can allege parole ineligibility in actions that should have formally been declaratory judgment in habeas corpus, then instead of having those tried in Cole County and go up the normal way, they spread out over the state.
So you're really saying we want lots of prisoners to file yet additional forms of action?
No. There are five of these people, and I'm saying I don't want them. I want them to stay exactly like it is. I think the Court of Appeals decision and their point relied on changes it. And I want it to be just what it was, an appeal of the denial of, an appeal of the grant of a judgment on the pleadings. And if there are no questions on that, I'll get to why the state wins, and well, not the state, but the Department of Corrections wins, and why consecutive sentences are different.
Go ahead. You said there are only five Graham cases.
Yeah. Well, let me see, and I'm going to define it because we may be talking about different things. What I put in one of my letter briefs in response to a question from the Court of Appeals was we found five people who had parole ineligibility for 60 years or more and weren't charged with murder, second-degree murder, or one of the manslaughters. And that was some months ago, so that may not be accurate, but it gives the court a flavor. And why the analysis is different. First of all, I'm going to talk about Miller v. Alabama and Montgomery. The analysis there is completely different than a Graham case, and the United States Supreme Court said that in Miller. In Miller, the United States Supreme Court was invited to do Graham-type analysis for consensus and application to the four reasons for punishment. The U.S. Supreme Court said, we don't have to do that here because Graham is categorical in that nobody can get that punishment. Miller is not categorical because we're narrowing and channeling. It's still substantive in the sense of retroactivity application, but it's not saying no juvenile can get punishment X, which Graham is saying. And then we go to the analysis, what did the U.S. Supreme Court say we do in a categorical case like Graham? And they said we do two things. We look for national consensus, and if we find it, and we say there's a national consensus about this punishment, then we do our own analysis, are the factors for penological reasons for punishment served by this punishment. And the analysis is completely different if you're talking about one sentence, or if you're talking about, in this case, seven sentences, or in the case of Bostick, who I think you guys did hear on habeas, 17 sentences that have ineligibility periods stacked. Go ahead.
Are you saying Graham addressed multiple sentences and said it would treat them differently?
I'm saying
it's that a juvenile and a non-homicide offense is categorically barred from being given life without parole, right?
I said on a single sentence, I think they said that. And
it was
the
Graham,
reason,
but this guy had two sentences, didn't he? So.
Well, no, he only had one that was life without parole.
Right.
He had a burglary, armed burglary, which they gave him life, and in Florida there was no parole. He had other stuff, but that wasn't relevant. What this court was talking about was this guy has got life without parole for armed burglary. I get that, but that is different than someone that does seven violent felonies or 17. This one, it was seven. Bostick, it was 17. That's different. Incapacitation reasoning is different. Specific deterrence is different. General deterrence is different, and retribution is different. This is a man, and you may see fact patterns like this in other cases, who made a decision to rob someone. Then he made a decision to kidnap someone. Then he psychologically tortured them. Then he stole their jewelry. Then he shot her four times and left her to die. So the four penological factors are very different. And what Graham says is if we are finding out if something is categorically unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment, we look at the penological factors and we look at consensus. And I want to talk a little bit about consensus. They cite six or seven, they cite a bunch of cases, but six or seven of them are in the roundhouse of the, you know, fairly down the middle of this is unconstitutional, a sentence like this. But none of those do the Graham analysis. None of them. None of them say consensus and run through the penological factors. All of them say juvenile, life without parole, not going to be released ever, therefore Graham violation. But none of those cases do the analysis. There's no consensus shown by those cases that the American people find that punishment unacceptable. They list six or seven statutes which largely overlap with the states that have found unconstitutionality under Graham without analysis. And what those statutes are, they're fixes. They're like R590. If this is unconstitutional, well then we'll make him parole eligible at 20 years or 15 years or whatever. That does not demonstrate a consensus that the people of those states or the legislatures of those states find the punishment unconstitutional because it's cruel and unusual. What they demonstrate is that the legislature tried to fix what they perceived as a court case saying, under Graham, we can't do this. But all those court cases were without analysis. Now, there's another factor, and I realize the Western District opinion has dropped out, and the Western District's dispositive reasoning was just like the reasoning I told you about consensus and about penological factors, but they also address the question of, is this a homicide offense? And if it's not, is Graham completely inapplicable? And they said, we don't have to reach it, but we question it, because although Graham used the phrase homicide, in the body of the text, they talked about people were less culpable and therefore less worthy of retribution because they had killed or intended to kill. So although they used the word homicide, there's some question about whether they even meant by homicide the result or the kill and intent to kill. And it's not drafted well, but the Court of Appeals noted that and said we don't have to reach that because we do it on the consensus and penological factors analysis, but it's there, and if this court were to get past those, I think this court would have to address it. I probably talked a long time. Does anybody have any questions?
We're listening.
Ah, well. Well, that's the key, I think, is we mush together Miller, and Miller doesn't apply because it's not categorical in the sense that it prevents the punishment for everybody. So as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Miller, it drops out. And what we're looking at here is a different punishment than a single sentence of life without parole for a single offense. We're looking about a whole list of offenses. And this court can go through the penological factors and the consensus that I've talked about and see that they don't apply, or at least apply very differently. Someone that's done a whole lot of bad things, there's a good argument they should be incapacitated more than somebody that's done one bad thing. Somebody that's done a whole lot of bad things, going down a scale of doing bad things over and over, they're probably more worthy of retribution than a juvenile that's done one very bad thing. and certainly deterrence. I want the man to stop after he takes the car. I want him to stop after he takes the jewelry. I want him to stop before he kidnaps the lady and throws her in the trunk of the car. I want him to stop before he takes her to the lake and shoots her four times with a shotgun, the last time in the head, maiming and disfiguring. And deterrence argues that that would happen, or at least it should happen or reasonably could happen, so we're on the right side of Graham analysis here. I think I'll sit down if there are no questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If it please the court, I think the way Graham describes the whole process is that whether or not there is more than one offense, like Graham committed, or only one offense, the penological justifications are the same. They specifically said the distinctive attributes of youth, diminish the penological justifications for imposing the harshest sentences on juvenile offenders, even when they commit terrible crimes. And so what the focus was is that when you have a juvenile and their brain is not fully developed, they are not sitting there thinking, you know, if I commit this crime, I think I'm going to get 10 to 20, but if I can do that other one, I might actually have to do an extra 5 years of parole, so I'm not going to do it. Juveniles do not think that way. Okay, we know that. We see that. I mean, you see a kid
said... Is the parole board permitted to consider the heinousness of the crimes and the
definitely.
Multiple crimes?
That's where that comes in. And so if there are multiple crimes, I'm not saying that multiple crimes make no difference, right? It makes a difference later. What you can't make a difference on is at the outset. You can't say, okay, you committed one crime, so you're eligible for parole. You committed three crimes, so you're never, ever going to be eligible for parole. And Graham specifically says you can't make that decision at the outset. Now, at parole hearing, you come in there, and let's face it, the parole board guidelines say the victims are all entitled, you have all the rights. And they parade 7-8 victims in front of the parole board. What do we think is going to happen? So it's not that the number of crimes or victims makes no difference.
What's the remedy that you want this court to order, or you wanted the trial court to order, precisely?
I want the court to grant habeas relief and to remand it for the trial court to resentence, to give him a meaningful opportunity.
So you think habeas is the characterization of the actions habeas is correct?
I think it is. Because
well, in terms of the relief you're asking for, what's meaningful opportunity? How many years short of his statistical lifespan is meaningful? 5, 10? Or do you think that meaningful means he has to be eligible immediately?
No.
Okay, no, well, so where in the middle there?
No, I definitely don't think he has to be eligible immediately. I mean, certainly, I think 25 would be. I don't see anything unconstitutional of the 85% on the life, although I will say that Iowa would disagree, because Iowa says when you're dealing with a juvenile, you shouldn't have any minimum term offenders.
Now, didn't they use that based on their own state constitution?
They did that based on their own state constitution. Exactly. So I'm not going that far. I do think that when you're dealing with beyond life expectancy, regardless of which chart you use, 85 is beyond that. And I do think that geriatric, as I argued in the Carr case, geriatric is not a meaningful, realistic opportunity for release. Beyond that, the courts really haven't given much guidance. And I think the trial court should have some discretion with some guidance from the court as an indication that we don't believe that a geriatric release would be meaningful. But you
agree that most generally these parole eligibility issues based on statutes are done through the declaratory judgment practice?
Well, I think a lot of them are, but this is a different situation because... because here you're talking about an overall sentence, right? I mean, technically, the minimum term sentence statute would be okay if the judge had run the sentences concurrent. Right? My client would be eligible for parole after 25.5. So I think the habeas acts, I think the Western District was correct. Well, that's originally how we started. We started off with this court filing habeas corpus, and then we did circuit court in habeas corpus. And finally, everybody was saying we have the declaratory judgment, so we go that way. And then the Western District said, no, you're right the first time. And I think they were correct. that it is a habeas corpus action because you're looking at the overall sentence. And is this person going to have a meaningful opportunity to serve to be eligible for parole?
But you're not really looking at the overall sentence. You're looking at the parole statute effect of the combined sentence.
Well,
let me finish this thought, and okay. maybe you'll agree with me. So what you really think ought to be required is a statute similar to the geriatric version that just applies to minors that says anybody who's convicted of multiple offenses after you've served 25 years, you're eligible for parole.
Would I be in favor of such a statute? Yes, I would. I don't know that it's constitutionally required. What I'm asking for is resentencing to give this individual an opportunity for a meaningful. Now, if the court decides that the best.
I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt. But what gives the trial court the authority to give sentences that. Maybe this person wouldn't be stacked. What you suggest is that the trial court would be required to give concurrent sentences. What sort of sentence is permissible within the current statutory range for your client that would be constitutional?
Well for my client, because it's complicated by the minimum term. It's complicated. It's like the Nunk court in Iowa, said, okay, we're not saying that you can't necessarily give consecutive, but if you're deciding whether or not this sentence should run consecutive to this sentence or whatever, you have to keep in mind the overall picture to allow the defendant to have a meaningful opportunity. So in some juveniles, it would be okay, I think, to run consecutive sentences depending on the parole guidelines. And for some, I think with the minimum term, you could have a constitutional problem. But that's why I believe it's a habeas corpus action, because you're not saying that the minimum term statutes are unconstitutional for everybody. For instance, like if a juvenile came in with a 5-year, a minimum sentence of like 10 or something like that, it'd be hard pressed to say that it'd be unconstitutional to do a minimum term on that. But that's why I think it's a habeas corpus action. Now the court could cure the problem by finding a minimum term statute unconstitutional as to juveniles, and that would be fine. But it's not required. And Will Banks, initially in the habeas in front of this court, asked for alternative to find the minimum term unconstitutional or to remand for resentencing.
Any other questions?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.